Good afternoon, everyone. I'm pleased that so many of you were able to join our statewide collaborative conference call today focusing in on surgical infection prevention. Before we begin our formal presentations by Dr. Philip Barry and Denise Faulkner-Cameron, I just wanted to take an opportunity to make sure that everybody kind of was on the same page. As much as possible, I'm going to try to do that. This statewide collaborative is IPRO's fourth collaborative. We carried out and completed one previously on surgical infection prevention. We completed a collaborative on pneumonia, and we're in the process of carrying out our second pneumonia collaborative. And we're also coming to completion on a smoking cessation collaborative. Now, the collaboratives that we've carried out thus far are based on the IHI methodology. The approach that they take is to have to develop a team that is have hospitals develop a team that's committed to a topic specific their topic specific quality improvement efforts. Usually, there are four face-to-face meetings that are either a full day or a day and a half. IPRO has hosted those meetings with, you know, keynote speakers and educational sessions. There are also monthly conference calls that are carried out, which are hosted by IPRO. Monthly reports are submitted, and we offer ongoing technical support. Certainly, their mantra is that together hospitals can accomplish more than they would be able to do by themselves. They encourage hospitals to start small and to spread and to steal shamelessly, to learn from one another, share information, and learn from one another so that we're not all reinventing the wheel. Our previous collaboratives have been extremely successful. We wanted to carry out another one, but due to time constraints that we've had, we had to modify the approach to this particular collaborative that we're engaged in now. And our goal was also to be able to offer this collaborative opportunity to a larger proportion of hospitals across the state. We certainly know face-to-face meetings are very, very beneficial, but it is also true that it's very difficult for many hospitals to travel because of budgetary constraints and time constraints. So in looking for a viable alternative, we thought that the conference calls would be a way to go. We also knew that not every hospital is able to commit to the same level of participation. So we also wanted to be able to offer to hospitals that were certainly interested in learning and hearing information. We wanted to give them an opportunity to be able to do that. So for hospitals that were ready to participate fully, we encourage them to do so. Others who may want to continue work already started in previous collaboratives or quality improvement work that they're doing on their own, they can continue and enhance what they're doing. And we also wanted to offer an opportunity for those who needed to listen and learn before they undertook any particular strategies to be able to do so. So we kind of felt that it was a win-win situation for everyone. So we started out this collaborative basically the same way we did with the others. We sent out pre-work information. We wanted hospitals to take a look at what they're currently doing, how they're doing, et cetera. Encourage them to develop a team. We posted the agenda of the conference calls to our website. We developed a specific website for this collaborative so that you all could have an easy way to share information and communicate with one another. The message here is that the more that you communicate with one another and share, the better this collaborative will be. We also identified specific contacts for each one of the clinical topics so that you could have a person that you would know that would have information specific to the clinical topic that you're interested in. And, of course, I'm assuming that most of you here today are interested in the prevention of surgical wound infections. This is our third conference call in the series that we've put together for the next year. The first focused on the IHI quality improvement methodology. The second for people that were interested in working on cardiac care, focused on cardiac care, and this one is going to focus today on surgical infection prevention. It's also a topic of interest because it's recently been added to the JACO core measures. So I am going to turn you over to Denise Faulkner, who is going to introduce our keynote speaker for today, Dr. Philip Barry. If you did not have an opportunity to download the slides, please go to Jenny, J-E-N-Y, .ipro.org, and you will be able to follow along on the slides as we go forward. If you have any questions, we'll be able to answer all of your questions at the opportune time, and we'll let you know when that will be. So, Denise, I'm going to let you introduce Dr. Barry, and we'll get started. Thank you.
And thank you, Peggy, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just going to provide to you a brief background on our keynote speaker, Dr. Philip Barry. Dr. Philip Barry is a tenured professor of surgery and public health at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He is the chief of the Division of Critical Care and Trauma and the director of the Ann and Max A. Cohen Surgical Intensive Care Unit at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center. Dr. Barry is president of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. He's also the president-elect of the Surgical Infection Society, secretary and treasurer of the Halstead Society, and a counselor of the Society of Critical Care. In addition to his many other accomplishments, Dr. Barry is also the author or co-author of more than 150 peer-reviewed manuscripts, two books, and nearly 70 book chapters. He is the editor of Surgical Infections and serves on the editorial boards of several peer-reviewed journals, including Critical Care Medicine. Without further ado, I present to you Dr. Philip Barry.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm speaking to you from Manhattan as a transplanted Buffalonian. I hope everyone has dried out from last week's weather. We got 6 inches of rain in one day down here last Tuesday. I have had as one of my interests the prevention and management of surgical site infection for many years, and I'm happy to share some observations with you today. I am working off my laptop, not off the website. There are some animations in some of my slides, which some of you, depending upon your computer capabilities, may or may not be able to see. I'm not going to be discussing the animations because not all of you will be able to see them, and so just follow along as we move from slide to slide. I will try to say specifically that we're looking at the next slide to make it as easy as possible for you to follow along. The first slide shows you the CT scan of an abdomen. This woman had undergone an open appendectomy about a week previously, initially did well, but then came back into the emergency department with a fever and tenderness in the right lower quadrant and some drainage from her incision. And if you're not accustomed to looking at CT scans, you're looking at the patient as though they were laying in bed in front of you with their feet towards you. So the patient's right is on your left, and you can see that there's some haziness there and a gap in the muscles in the right lower quadrant, along with gas below the level of the muscles, gas above the level of the muscles, and gas present in the soft tissues. And that's certainly a fairly classic appearance of CT by CT scan of a surgical site infection following appendectomy. In case you're wondering why we're using the terminology surgical site infection rather than wound infection, which certainly is the colloquial term, surgical site infection is now the officially endorsed terminology of the CDC. Moving to the next slide, you can see that there are estimated to be in the United States upwards of 20 million surgical procedures per year, and about 500,000 patients develop a healthcare associated infection in the postoperative period. Most of those occur in the intensive care unit, and surgical site infection is now just about as common as pneumonia. as a post-operative infection. So although these don't necessarily make the patients as sick as some of the other healthcare associated infections that we see, they are certainly not to be trifled with. And the next slide, we see that surgical site infections represent about 15% of all healthcare associated infections, hospital associated infections, but among surgical patients, they are about 40% of the postoperative infections, with pneumonia accounting for another 40% or so of those infections. It's estimated that this may add as much as $10 billion annually to the cost of patient care in the United States. And a surgical site infection, because some of these are superficial, but others may be deep, including intracavitary infections of the abdomen or chest, it's estimated that they add a week to length of stay and more than $3,000 to hospital charges. Now, on the next slide, you can see a picture of a patient who had a severe postoperative infection. This incision, although it looks bad, actually looks good to the eye of a surgeon because there is some granulation tissue present. But you can see this with the drains below and the stoma on top and get a sense for the poor wound healing, the nutritional problems, and the extensiveness of this infection. If you look closely, just above the opening in the patient's, toward the bottom in the patient's left upper quadrant, you can actually see that there is some dehisced intestine there. So I think this picture speaks volumes about how devastating these problems can be. In the next slide, which is titled Traditional Classification of Operative Procedures, we come to some fairly standardized terminology that has actually been in use since the 1960s. And that relates to whether the incision is contaminated during a surgical procedure. A dirty incision is one in which the patient is actually operated on for infection, a perforated appendix, for example. A contaminated one is one in which there is some spillage into the operative field. For example, operation for bowel obstruction where an enterotomy is created and there's leakage of bowel contents into the operative field. It's controlled quickly before the bacteria have time to invade, so it's not an infection per se, but it increases the risk of infection dramatically, as you can see, to somewhere between 15 and 30%. A clean contaminated incision is one in which usually a gastrointestinal tract or respiratory tract, viscous, bronchus, cystic duct, colon, for example, is divided under controlled circumstances, elective colon resection, for example. You can see even under controlled circumstances that approximately triples the risk of surgical site infection compared to clean operations, which are ones where no hollow viscus is open. Common examples of that would be hernia surgery, breast surgery, thyroid surgery, and so on. Now, according to the Centers for Disease Control in the next slide and the NNIS, or National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program, there are three factors that define the risk of developing a postoperative surgical site infection. The first is the wound classification, and we just spoke about that, particularly, and the patients get one point if they have a contaminated or dirty wound. If they have multiple medical problems and they have an American Society of Anesthesiologists class 3 or higher score, which means active medical problems, and this, by the way, is calculated by every anesthesiologist for every case, and so if you just look at the operating room record, you'll be able to find it, and prolonged operative time defined as longer than the 75th percentile for whatever the operation is. That varies by operation. For example, an appendectomy that lasts longer than 1 hour is considered to be prolonged, but cardiac surgery isn't considered to be prolonged until patients have more than 5 hours worth of surgery. In the next slide, you can see the likelihood of the patient developing a surgical site infection, depending on whether they have none of these risk factors, a single factor, two or three risk factors. And so you can see the risk of infection goes up substantially when more risk factors are present. Interestingly, these kind of data, these kinds of results are replicated even when you consider any of a number of individual types of operations. So the same thing is true of breast surgery, hernia surgery, colon surgery considered in isolation. The more risk factors there are, the higher the risk of infection. That's not to say that there aren't other risk factors, but this is the way that the CDC classifies them. Now, in the next slide, which is entitled NNIS Risk Index as a Predictor of Risk of Infection, we now can see how this breaks out in a little bit more detail. So, for example, by definition, if it's a clean or clean contaminated, they don't have a risk factor. So, contaminated or dirty surgery, they do have a risk factor, so they can't have a risk index of zero. But you can see that even within a wound classification and as the number of risk factors increases, so too does the risk of surgical site infection. The overall incidence, according to the CDC, is estimated to be 2.8%, but this is probably an underestimate. Why? Because no one has figured out yet a good way to capture infections following ambulatory surgery. I don't know what the numbers are at your individual institutions, but I can imagine that they're probably similar to what happens at our institution, and that is that 70% of the surgery we're doing now at Cornell is ambulatory surgery. Voluntary reporting programs, no matter what is tried, the incidence of postoperative infection is clearly underreported. A better overall figure, just a guesstimate, is probably about 4%. The next slide shows NIS risk factors and SSI, and these are data collected over a six-year period ending 3 years ago. And this is just to show you by example how much the risk of surgical site infection goes up depending on how many of these risk factors are present. In the case of coronary artery bypass grafting, for example, where the infection rate is a composite rate for both the sternal incision and the lower extremity vein harvest sites, if there are no risk factors present, the risk of wound infection is 1.2%, whereas it is 8 times higher if all three factors are present. And again, the data are basically the same for any operation, although the numbers when it's clean surgery are going to be lower. On the next slide, surgical site infections and risk factors shows you by cartoon rather than numbers that the same thing is basically true. For thoracic surgery, for herniorrhaphy, for mastectomy, and for vascular surgery, that as the number of risk factors increases, so too does the risk of infection. But that said, looking at the next slide entitled Medical Conditions Known to Increase the Risk of Surgical Site Infection, you can see that there are a lot of other factors that are not strictly considered in the CDC paradigm. Very elderly patients, neonatal patients, are at increased risk. Patients who have undernutrition. In fact, one of the most powerful interventions that can be done to decrease the risk of surgical site infection is to provide enteral nutritional supplementation for a few days prior to surgery. Obesity and diabetes, unfortunately, go hand in hand. We'll talk specifically about diabetes toward the end of the talk where there are good data. Staphylococcal skin carriage, about 3 to 4% of normal healthy people are carriers of staphylococci on their skin. Patients who carry staphylococci are at increased risk of surgical site infection, and surgeons who are staphylococcal carriers are at increased risk of giving their patient an infection. Now, that's not to say that most of the infections that occur are a result of bad care. Most of the infections that occur, I think you can see, relate to the patient's underlying medical condition. Certainly, if the patient's undergoing elective surgery and has a remote infection, such as pharyngitis or a urinary tract infection, their surgery should be canceled. Hypocholesterolemia has been an area in which we've worked, and it turns out that not only is high cholesterol bad for you too, but so is low cholesterol if it's too low. And so there are a number of factors that need to be considered. When one looks at epidemiologic studies, as can be seen in the next slide, the study entitled Prediction Tool for Surgical Site Infection, this is a prospective study of more than 2,000 cardiac surgical patients. The incidence of surgical site infection was about 3.5%, and you can see that the risk factors for the development of an infection are listed below, with having insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus increasing the risk by 2.3-fold, obesity increasing the risk by 1.8-fold, and so on. In another similar evaluation, this one from Deborah Malone and her colleagues at the University of Maryland, the Baltimore VA Medical Center, a prospective study of 5,000 patients undergoing non-cardiac surgery now, the previous slide dealt with cardiac surgery, showed the incidence of surgical site infection to be 3.2%. Diabetes, postoperative anemia, recent weight loss, and ascites were all independent risk factors for the development of a surgical site infection. Now, as we move into some of the things that we as healthcare providers can do to minimize the risk, let me just take a moment to emphasize the importance of infection control. I hope that each of your institutions are worshiping at the altar of infection control. You absolutely have to have good infection control policies, procedures, and practices, or anything that we're going to talk about in terms of antibiotic prophylaxis or other interventions simply is not going to make much difference. Skin decontamination, the operating room environment, and a surveillance program are all very important. This next slide shows the major pathogens that can be expected in surgical site infection, and you will see that overwhelmingly the organisms responsible for surgical site infections are gram-positive cocci, Staphylococcus aureus, coagulase negative staph, and the enterococci being number 1, 2, and 3, and accounting together for more than half of these. These are skin flora. And these organisms get into the incision during the surgical procedure almost assuredly, and therefore skin preparation is very, very important. E. coli and anaerobic infections can be seen in patients who are undergoing intestinal surgery, colon surgery in particular. In the next slide, there's a cartoon which emphasizes the fact that an infection of the surgical incision can be superficial, which means above the level of the fascia, can be deep, which means that it involves levels of fascia and muscle, and not shown on this slide, the deepest component is actually what's called organ space infection. An example of that would be a subphrenic abscess after a splenectomy, for example, or a subhepatic abscess after a cholecystectomy for acute cholecystitis. Generally speaking, the deeper the infection, the less likely that they're going to be gram-positive cocci, and the more likely that they're going to be gram-negative bacilli and anaerobes, and so you can plan your antibiotic prophylaxis based on that. Now, even though these infections may be superficial, that does not mean that they may not be hazardous. This study by Gottlieb et al. In the next slide shows you that among 73 surgical patients who had a postoperative Staph aureus bacteremia, the surgical site was the origin of the bacteremia in 2/3 of the cases. About 20 4% of the Staph aureus bacteremias in the institution of the period of study were postoperative in origin. And what's very important to remember, in particular with Staph aureus bacteremia, is that a third of the patients develop a secondary complication. Staph can stick to heart valves and can embolize other tissues, cause metastatic abscesses of the lung, and so on. So even though we think of these as being relatively straightforward infections to deal with, they can have very serious consequences. Now, in the next slide, the Hospital Infections Program from the CDC published a guideline in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology and on their website in 1999, looking at the interventions that can prevent surgical site infection. Their Category 1 is the same as Class 1 evidence. I would point out a few things to you. We talked about the patients not having a concurrent infection. Shaving in advance has ended, particularly with a blade. We used to shave the skin the night before. Now those little nicks and cuts get colonized and actually increase the risk of infection. So electric clippers in the operating room, no more shaving in advance. Controlling glucose is very important. Patients should shower the night before with an antiseptic soap, chlorhexidine-based soap being ideal. I think that's another thing that we forget. Prophylactic antibiotics have to be given. They have to be given correctly, but it is not a be-all and end-all. Minimize traffic, minimize talking, make sure the instrumentation is properly sterilized. Gloves are important. Closed suction drains should be used, and drains should be removed as soon as possible. In the next slide, we ask the question, why do we bother to scrub? We wear sterile gloves. This is a classic study by Cruz from 30 years ago, in which you can see that if a glove puncture occurs during a case, and gloves, the integrity of sterile surgical gloves is actually breached in as many as 20% of operations, particularly if there is bone involved. So orthopedic surgery, cardiac surgery, neurosurgery, all is at very high risk for loss of glove integrity, and that alone triples the risk of surgical site infection. However, we've been diminishing the importance of the surgical scrub. We no longer do 10-minute soap scrubs. Many institutions no longer do 5-minute soap scrubs. The more that the skin is debrided by the scrub process, the more that deeper bacteria brought to the surface. And if your institution has switched to the alcohol gel-based preoperative hand cleansing, that's fine. The data suggests that that's absolutely true. The next slide shows a couple of Category 2 recommendations, which this is where there's some soft data. Keep the preoperative stay short. Don't bring patients into the hospital any longer than necessary. Of course, it's very difficult to do that anyway. But people who are in the hospital get colonized with hospital bacteria, and their risk of infection does go up. Interestingly enough, the CDC had no recommendation about stopping or reducing steroids, no recommendation about topical antibiotics for patients who are staphylococcal carriers, or about providing preoperative nutritional support. Since this 1999 report, we've had some additional data about nutritional support and about nasal mupirocin ointment. On the next slide, the yin and yang of appropriate antibiotic prophylaxis in our favor is that when it's given well, it reduces infection rates, reduces costs, and decreases mortality, but they have to be given appropriately, and inappropriately can lead to increased adverse events, an increased likelihood of resistant pathogens, and an increase in global resistance, not to mention superinfections. In the next slide, Trish Pearl from Johns Hopkins published in the New England Journal in 2002 her study of intranasal mupirocin to prevent postoperative Staph aureus infections. This is a very interesting paper, and I commend it to your reading. When given to a population of patients as a whole, it really didn't reduce the incidence of surgical site infection. But what's important here is that if you have a patient who's a carrier, It reduced the infection rate by half, the odds ratio being 0.49. How do you suspect that a patient might be a carrier? Well, a patient with a history of multiple bouts of skin abscesses or furunculosis, or a patient with a prior history of a postoperative surgical site infection probably should be screened with a nasal swab for the presence of Staphylococcus aureus. And if a patient such as that is found, I think that the topical antibiotic ointment is a reasonable thing to do. In the next slide, we ask the general question, when should antibiotic prophylaxis be used? And the general recommendations are for procedures with a high rate of surgical site infections, and those are clean contaminated operations, with some exceptions, and contaminated operations, such as laparotomy for small bowel obstruction. It is less clear, but widely practiced, that antibiotic prophylaxis should cover implantation of prosthetic materials. Certainly, a hip prosthesis should be covered, or a knee prosthesis. There's little discussion about whether a vascular graft should be covered, but there's really no data to suggest, for example, that mesh placed for hernia repair needs to be covered. The principles of giving an antibiotic appropriately are shown in the next slide. We want to give a short duration. We want the agent to cover the suspected organisms, which means for the most part gram-positive cocci. We need to dose it properly. We need to give a narrow spectrum. We do not want to be giving our big guns as surgical prophylaxis, meaning hopefully no third-generation cephalosporins. And we want, obviously, the antibiotic to be safe. Let's talk for a moment about clean surgical procedures, hernia, breast, thyroid, so on. Most of these cases do not require antibiotics. They can be indicated, as we said, when patients have prosthetic materials put in. The data are conflicting as to whether breast surgery and hernia surgery requires antibiotic prophylaxis. As a general rule, cefazolin is the drug. Recent consensus has emerged suggesting that for penicillin-allergic patients, the drug should not be vancomycin, but rather should be clindamycin. It has excellent coverage of staph and strep, although not MRSA, and so vancomycin prophylaxis really should be limited to circumstances where you're worried about MRSA, as we can see in the next slide. No one has really specified how high a risk that needs to be, but if your hospital infection rate for Staph aureus is more than 20% MRSA, or you're operating on a patient with certain known high-risk conditions, such as being a dialysis patient, this is reasonable to consider. Why isn't a more broad recommendation being made? Well, quite simply, we're trying to limit vancomycin use so that we can limit the prospect of resistance developing to vancomycin among gram-positive cocci. The next slide from Asensio is a Spanish study showing that the risk of acquiring MRSA increases dramatically as the number of invasive procedures performed on a patient increases. Now, this is invasive procedures of all types, not just incisions, but central venous catheters, arterial lines, chest tubes, and all of that. And you can see that even a single procedure increases the chance of developing MRSA by 3 to 4-fold. If 3 procedures are performed on a patient and a critically ill patient, that's entirely within the prospect. The chance of developing MRSA can go up by a factor of 20. The other thing that this study showed, which is very interesting, is that even a single day's worth of antibiotic administration, shown in the next slide, can approximately double the risk of acquiring MRSA. That's correct, ladies and gentlemen. There are now data, this study as well as others, suggesting that even a single day of antibiotics increases the risk of developing an MRSA surgical site infection. So we really, really need to work to minimize this antibiotic exposure as much as possible. A classic study was published by Klassen and co-workers on the timing of antibiotic prophylaxis and the risk of SSI in the next slide. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1992. It is a timeless study. What they did was look at the relationship of the timing either before or after surgery of the administration of antibiotics and the risk of developing a surgical site infection. In the next slide, you can see that the risk of surgical site infection was minimized when the antibiotic was given within 1 hour before the incision was made, ideally at about 30 minutes before, so that concentrations will be at their highest at the time the incision is made. If the first dose is given after the incision but during the surgery, there is a modest protective effect, but there is no benefit to giving antibiotics when you get out beyond 4 or 5 hours. Why? Well, before we talk about why, let's talk about what the data show. The next slide shows perioperative prophylactic antibiotics and duration of use. How prevalent is prolonged antibiotic prophylaxis in the United States? In the Klassen study in 1992, virtually every patient got at least 24 hours worth of antibiotics and up to 48 hours worth, and 80% of the patients got more than 48 hours worth of antibiotics. The data suggest, as we shall see, that a single dose is appropriate for most cases. For longer cases, an intraoperative dose can be given. But once the incision is closed, the antibiotics can't get to the incision, and they really don't help. Those postoperative doses of antibiotics really don't help. Even now, in data collected by the federal government last year as part of the Surgical Infection Prevention Project, 60% of patients in the United States are receiving antibiotic prophylaxis for greater than 24 hours. The standard that's being put forth is no longer than 24 hours, but be aware that as soon as the patient's out of the operating room, the likelihood that these antibiotics are going to help is really quite small. And the reason is shown in the next slide, and that is that fresh incisions are ischemic. Why? Because surgeons go to a lot of trouble to get hemostasis, to seal blood vessels. And antibiotics cannot be delivered effectively to a fresh wound until those wounds revascularize. That takes 24 to 48 hours. In the next slide, we can see that most studies have confirmed the efficacy of antibiotic prophylaxis for no more than 12 hours. And in fact, a single dose is efficacious. The next slide shows one of the first meta-analyses published in the medical literature from New Zealand in 1968, and looking at about 28 studies, and you can see the summary results are the four tick marks over at the far side. And you can see that the standard error bars fall over 1 in each circumstance. This shows clearly, and we've known this now essentially for 36 years, that a single dose of antibiotic prophylaxis is as effective as multiple doses for the prevention of surgical site infections. One group of surgeons that clings tenaciously to multiple doses or multiple days of antibiotic prophylaxis are the cardiac surgeons. And we now have several studies, as shown in this next slide, showing that one or two doses or shorter courses as opposed to longer courses actually produce equivalent infection rates. So as far as I'm concerned, even the cardiac surgeons no longer have any justification to consider prolonged antibiotic prophylaxis. The same thing can be shown for joint replacement in the next slide. Again, showing that the infection rate is the same with a single dose or 12 hours of antibiotics compared to longer courses of therapy. So although certainly an infected joint prosthesis is a clinical catastrophe, giving more antibiotics does not indemnify you against that risk. Here's another study. Actually, this slide I think we'll skip, and we'll go ahead to the slide entitled Reasons for Disconnect Between Accepted Guidelines and Everyday Practice. There are many reasons, and as you adopt this change into your culture, you're going to have to get buy-in from nursing, you're going to have to get buy-in from surgeons, you're going to have to get buy-in from anesthesiologists, because oftentimes they are the ones who actually have to give the antibiotic in a timely basis. This is a complex process. Vancomycin in particular requires an hour infusion to avoid red man syndrome, and I think this particular slide summarizes nicely some of the issues that you may find impeding your ability to make change. just want to show you briefly some data that we collected from New York State back about 10 years ago. This is a retrospective review of about 2,700 charts from 44 hospitals in New York State. And interestingly enough, among colon, aortic, and hip replacement surgery, all indications where antibiotic prophylaxis is indicated, only 55% of patients in the 1990s in New York State received antibiotic prophylaxis appropriately. Amazingly, almost 20% of these patients, even though antibiotic prophylaxis was clearly indicated, didn't receive any at all. Let's move ahead, skip a slide, and now look at the summary entitled Choice and Timeliness of Antibiotic Prophylaxis. One of the other things we found was that 44 different antibiotics were utilized, clearly we do not need to be using 44 different antibiotics for prophylaxis. Cefazolin, cefoxitin or cefotetan for colon surgery, vancomycin for high-risk MRSA, clindamycin for most other cases, covers maybe 95% of the usage that you ought to see. The penicillin allergic problem, sometimes a quinolone plus metronidazole can be used, but still we're only up to 6 different antibiotics. We simply do not need to be using, in particular, the third-generation cephalosporins or the quinolone for this problem. Here's a study published in Clinical Infectious Diseases looking at prophylactic antibiotic use patterns and changes over a decade. And here some interventions were performed, and you can see that the incidence of later never antibiotics went down up till 1991, and the incidence of on-time antibiotics went up. The third arrow over shows when a standing order was removed, and immediately change was seen in a negative direction. So the message here for you, ladies and gentlemen, is that you implement these procedures, but you're going to have to follow up on them because behavior and inertia being what they are, there's going to be a substantial tendency to revert back to old bad practices. So in summary, we want to use the narrowest spectrum to cover the likely pathogens. We want to avoid agents that are therapeutic choices. In my opinion, third or fourth generation cephalosporins never really should be used. Agents with moderately long half-life and good safety profile should be used. There are some additional slides posted on the website for your interest, some of which look at the development in particular of MRSA, but I think we'll stop here to allow time for our second presenter, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them for you anyway. Again, thank you very much for your time and your attention.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press 1 followed by 4 on your touch-tone phone. If you need to retract your question, please press 1 followed by 3. All questions will be taken in the order they are received, and once again, to ask a question, 1 followed by 4 on your touch-tone phone at this time, please. And our first question does come from Louise Cotto. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my question is, what's the standard of care for antibiotic treatment in C-sections? Do you still give the dose before the incision, or do you wait till after the delivery of the infant?
It's usually done either, it can be done either way, but I think the standard of care is to give the antibiotic immediately on clamping of the umbilical cord. So that would generally be intraoperative. But quite honestly, most of the agents that we're talking about for prophylaxis are safe for neonates and infants. So this may be an area where standard of practice is lagging behind our knowledge of biology.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And once again, to ask a question, 1 followed by 4 on your touch-tone phone at this time, please. And our next question comes from Betty Ann Whitbeck. Go ahead, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I had a question about the optimal.
I just lost our caller.
Okay. Our next question does come from Susan McClinsey. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Berry.
Sure.
I had used some of your material, giving you credit at a recent ORN service, trying to generate some interest in helping. They focused, and I wonder if you could elaborate on the how hypocholesterolemia and the type of analgesia figure in a surgical site infection risk factors, or point me to the reference.
Well, thank you for your question. Our hypocholesterolemia work was just published in Surgical Infections. And if you don't have that journal in your library, you can go on the publisher's website, Mary Ann Liebert, L-I-E-B-E-R-T. If you just Google Mary Ann, A-N-N Liebert, you can find her.
Nice.
And the journal has a web page. It turns out that probably what's important is that cholesterol, and particular apolipoprotein A1, are very important as scavenger and trafficking proteins to scavenge endotoxin. And so they may actually be important in reducing toxicity. As part of the stress response, cholesterol actually is internalized by macrophages, and they may become less effective infection-fighting cells.
Oh, you're busy. Mm-hmm.
Right. Your question about analgesia is very interesting as well. Also in surgical infections, going back a couple of years ago, was a paper suggesting that the risk of infection following colon surgery may actually be increased by morphine PCA. There is an emerging literature suggesting that local anesthetics may have very important protective effects. And so one of the reasons why the wound infection rates may be so low with clean surgery is that many of those operations are done under local anesthesia. Okay. And at least in animal studies, local anesthetics in an incision decrease the risk of surgical site infection. That's a great question.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for everything.
Sure.
Just wonderful.
Thank you. And our next question does come from Betty Ann Whitbeck. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Okay.
Our next question is going to come from Jean-Noire Dumatier. Go ahead, please.
I've got a couple of questions. First question was, you referred to the increased risk of MRSA being the hospital MRSA infection rate is more than 20%.
Yes.
So do you mean that? I mean, that would, I think, would be almost every hospital.
It would, and that's the problem with that number. But that's what's in the literature. Now, of course, as you very well point out, almost everybody's hospital is 50% MRSA, and so you're going to have to make your own decision as an institution as to whether you want vancomycin used for surgical prophylaxis.
And on that same slide, you talked about use of vancomycin plus cefazolin together. Could you comment on that? I mean, there's certainly some data to say that patients who get vancomycin get MSSA infections, and people who get cefazolin get MRSA infections. So it's certainly...
That's correct. But really, the combination was aimed at infrainguinal surgery in patients who are penicillin allergic, and this is particularly important for peripheral vascular surgery, where the groin is obviously a fairly dirty place, and leg surgery probably does need some gram-negative coverage.
Okay. Is there any data out there for doing like the rapid screening preoperatively to identify patients who are already colonized? Or?
Yes, there is. It's mostly in the cardiac surgical literature, but if you look in the journal Surgery in the last year or so and search on a cardiac surgeon from the Cleveland Clinic named Michael Banbury, B-A-N-B-U-R-Y, who happens to be one of my former residents, he's been doing some nice work with rapid turnaround PCR for the identification of people who are colonized. It's a good question.
If it's positive, then the PCR, do you give mupirocin or do you give vancomycin prophylaxis?
Well, it depends on when you're doing the screening. If you're screening the patients well in advance and they're still outpatients, then I would try to eradicate the carrier state with mupirocin. And there are other regimens as well, mupirocin plus oral rifampin is another potential regimen. But if you're testing the patients immediately beforehand, as they come into the holding area, for example, 3 hours before they're going to have their surgery, then you probably will end up giving vancomycin.
Can we ask one more question?
Yes.
How about changing the surgical scrub from betadine to ChlorPrep? the chlorhexidine plus alcohol. Is there any data or that it's more beneficial because it's a rapid kill and the killing lasts longer?
Well, one of the things that's underappreciated about povidone iodine or betadine is that it's not bactericidal until it's dry.
Right.
And so, yes, I think that the data increasingly are showing that chlorhexidine-based skin preparation regimens are better.
So should is there going to be like a recommendation to change all the cleaning to that the chlorhexidine?
No, I wouldn't anticipate that recommendation. My guess is that the CDC probably won't be updating the surgical site infection guidelines for another 5 to 7 years. So that's just the kind of thing you're going to have to keep your eye on the literature and make your own decision.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to have to call it now, so thank you very much. I do want to leave ample time for our next speaker. Thank you again.
Denise? Good afternoon again, once again, ladies and gentlemen. We want to thank Dr. Berry for that in-depth discussion as well as the questions that he answered. Before I begin, I just wanted to say if any participants that are online have had difficulties with downloading the presentation slides, they've been reposted and they've been reposted both in the PDF format as well as the PowerPoint format. So we apologize for any inconvenience and we hope that you're able to download them at this point. Now, as the contact for the surgical infection prevention component of this statewide collaborative, I'm just going to take a few moments and review this clinical topic and specifically talk about some quality improvement strategies as they pertain to surgical infection prevention. And the objectives of this presentation is to first begin with a brief background of the Surgical Infection Prevention Project. And then we're going to go into some specifics with regards to quality improvement efforts, which include developing an aim statement, developing change concepts, and testing those concepts with regards to your quality improvement efforts. And then we're going to wrap up by just briefly going over the timeline for this collaborative as well as our online information resource, which we call Jenny. Now, early in his presentation, Dr. Berry shared some statistics on the rate of occurrence and costs associated with surgical site infections, or SSIs. Now, just to reiterate what Dr. Berry told us, patients who develop SSIs are 60% more likely to spend time in an ICU, 5 times more likely to be admitted to the hospital, and have twice the incidence of mortality. So in response to the ongoing prevalence of SSIs, CMS and the Centers for Disease Control implemented the National Surgical Infection Prevention, or the SIP project. And the goal of this SIP project is to decrease the morbidity and mortality associated with postoperative SSIs in the Medicare population. And this is done by promoting the appropriate selection and timing of prophylactic antibiotics. Now, a panel of experts in surgical infection prevention, hospital infection control, and epidemiology developed 3 performance measures for national surveillance and quality improvement. And these 3 measures you will find on the 5th slide, and they're measures that we have all become familiar with over time. And they all have to deal with the on-time administering of prophylactic antibiotics, the appropriate selection of antibiotics, and discontinuance of those antibiotics within 24 hours. Now, for the purpose of national surveillance, the SIP project focuses on surgical procedures that are commonly performed on Medicare patients for which there is currently no debate over the need for prophylaxis. And these surgical procedures are outlined on slide number 6. Which include CABG procedures, cardiac surgery, vascular surgery, colon, hip and knee, and hysterectomy. Now, as stated previously, we're going to focus on the clinical topic of SIP and quality improvement strategies. Now, to begin, there are some questions that you would need to ask. The first question is,
what is it we're trying to accomplish? For many of you, since you've expressed interest in this specific topic for the collaborative, some examples of answers to that question may be to prevent the occurrence of SSIs in surgical patients or to improve the quality of care for surgical patients. And answering that question brings you to the next question, which is, how do we know that an improvement is needed? And you will find the answer to this question in a number of ways. You may begin, for example, by looking at your current practices. How is your hospital ensuring that patients are receiving antibiotics within a timely manner? Or are they receiving the appropriate antibiotics? Next, you may want to answer that question by examining your data. For example, what percentage of your patients are receiving antibiotics with 1 hour of the start of surgery? Then finally, once you determine that the improvements are in fact needed, the next question you will ask yourself is, what changes can we implement that will result in an improvement? So now that you've determined that improvements in this area of patient care is needed, that brings you back to the first question from the previous slide, which is, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? And that brings us to the topic of aim statement. And developing an aim statement is a very important aspect in collaborative work. And what the aim statement does is clearly state what it is that you and your team are trying to accomplish with regard to the particular area of care. And this aim statement should specifically include numerical goals and targets. For example, what percentage of on-time prophylaxis administration are you trying to achieve, and what time frame are you looking to achieve that in? And you need to also be realistic about what you're trying to accomplish. For example, can you improve the percentage of surgical patients who receive prophylactic antibiotics within 1 hour from 40% to 60%, and again, that's your numerical goal within a specified time frame, which would be 2 weeks. So on the next slide, we would see, once you've answered all those questions, it brings us to an example of an actual aim statement, which would be to increase the percent of surgical patients undergoing hysterectomies who receive prophylactic antibiotics within 1 hour prior to surgery from 60% to 100% in 12 months. And we'll see that we're looking at a specific population in the example of this aim statement, which are patients undergoing hysterectomies. And with regards to the numerical goals, you could decide how you want to state them. Here we went from 60% to 100% to suggest that your baseline or where your current data would show you that you're currently at a 60% rate for that particular measure, and your goal is to increase it to 100% or 40% within 12 months or a year. Now that you have your aim statement, we go back to the question as to what changes we can implement that will result in an improvement, which brings us to the topic of change concepts. And change concepts are simply ideas that a hospital would develop to test to see if those changes actually bring about improvements. And some examples of SIP change concepts would include developing standardized protocols that would stipulate that surgical patients receive their antibiotics within the holding area, or a standardized protocol that stipulates that the antibiotics would be delivered to the OR with the patient, or that pharmacy has the responsibility of delivering those antibiotics to the OR, or the anesthesiologist, him or herself, has the responsibility of administering those antibiotics. Other SIP change concepts would include developing and using pre-printed orders, as well as having education on the current guidelines for administering prophylaxis antibiotics to your hospital staff and providing feedback to the staff with
in relation to those guidelines. And all these change concepts together are designed to contribute to a smooth and successful SSI prevention program. Now, the next series of slides just outline some examples of various problems or barriers or obstacles that the hospitals may be currently facing, and we included some SIP change concepts that you may want to use in approaching those various barriers. And the first we see is elective procedures versus emergent procedures. And an approach to that might be to focus on an easier group, for instance, the elective procedures, because those are procedures that are scheduled as opposed to emergent surgical procedures that occur on an ad hoc basis. And the idea would be to focus on one surgical procedure, perfect that particular strategy, and then once you test your changes and see how well they're doing, you might want to spread across to other procedures. The second problem, an example of a second problem, would be that a consistent approach to where and when antibiotics are prepared and delivered may not exist. And some concept changes that you might want to implement to approach this particular area may be to have the antibiotics premixed in the OR holding area, or have the pharmacy deliver the antibiotics directly to the OR, and that would be based on an established OR schedule for that particular day. And to accommodate this, you might find that you may need to expand your pharmacy hours to make sure that there's adequate coverage for the first surgical procedure for the day to the last. And the last one may be to develop clear nursing policies regarding the process and roles of responsibilities for antibiotic delivery. The next problem would be consistently administer antibiotics within 1 hour prior to incision time despite anticipated OR delays. We may all be familiar with Murphy's Law, and whatever can go wrong will go wrong. So in this case, you may want to strongly consider having a protocol in place that makes the antibiotic administration part of the process immediately before the start of surgery. And some caveats to that would be to keep the antibiotic clearly labeled to reduce confusion, have either the pre-op or scrub nurse or the anesthesiologist himself have the primary responsibility to begin infusing the antibiotic. And visible reminders would also be very useful to prompt timely administration. And examples of that would be posting signs in the OR, having adhesive colored, bright colored stickies as part of the patient chart, or even as part of the checklist. Another problem would be how to deal with antibiotics that require more than 1 hour to infuse. Now, we know that most antibiotics should start infusing within 1 hour prior to incision. However, vancomycin is an exception to this rule. So we're just something to keep in mind with regards to this measure, that the antibiotics are to begin within the 1 hour time frame. So approach to a case like vancomycin may be to have the pre-op nurse start these patients on antibiotics prior to coming to the OR or in the OR holding area. And then one last change concept that we want to share with you has to deal with the selection of antibiotics that are not consistent with current guidelines. Encouraging physician buy-in for this project may be one approach that you might want to take. Also, the development and utilization of pre-printed orders would also be beneficial. Educating your providers on an ongoing basis by disseminating current guidelines would also help. And in services,
for education purposes would be good, as well as offering to provide CME credits for all those who participate. And then provide feedback on an ongoing basis, and that could be done through means of your data. Show the rate of compliance and how often the guidelines are actually being adhered to. So once you have, you develop your change concepts and you implement them, the next step is to actually test those changes. And testing is very important because it answers the question, have we accomplished what we set out to do? And a mantra for testing changes is to start small and test rapidly. And an example of starting small is to focus on the surgical procedures that are performed on by one doctor, or look at one specific surgical procedure and the portion of one doctor's cases. And then you want to test rapidly, for example, within 1 or 2 weeks. And the reason test rapidly is important because you want to know up front whether ahead of time if a particular concept change is or is not working. You don't want too much time to go by to see that something is or is not working so you can begin implementing it. All right, you want to test those innovative changes on a small scale. Again, look at either one physician or one population, which would be patients that are undergoing a specific procedure. And then you want to start with changes that are easy to implement. For example, we mentioned a concept of our approach is to have pharmacy deliver the antibiotics to the OR. If that's if that's an administrative change that's easy to implement, you might want to start with that as opposed to something that would be a little bit more complex. Then you want to monitor your progress on an ongoing basis, preferably daily or weekly. Again, going back to testing rapidly over small periods of time. And then after that, once you look at your data and you can answer the question, did these changes accomplish what we wanted? And if your answer to that question is yes, then you could begin spreading these changes to other populations, to other surgical procedures, or to other physicians as well. Okay, the next slide is an outline of our collaborative timeline. And as you can see, it's broken down into 3 phases. And the collaborative, as you will see, began in August. And we are currently in the pre-work begin action period. And it's at this point where hospitals have shared their pre-work packages with us. They've looked at their current processes and procedures and baseline data to decide where they would like to focus their QI efforts. I just want to add here, if anyone did not receive this pre-work package, please contact me and I'll be more than happy to share it with you. It is on our website, and I'll give you more information as to how to contact me to get that. Like I said, we're in the action phase for those who wish to collaborate at this time. And at this point, teams are putting together their aim statement and will now begin to implement some of the the change concepts that we have shared with you during this presentation, and you can begin implementing those changes, which will bring you to the action period phase of the collaborative, where you're actually implementing those changes and testing them to see if they're resulting in the improvements that you're seeking. And then the final phase is our outcomes phase, where we actually evaluate what we have done and are able to see if they have resulted in the desired outcomes. Okay, on the next slide, we're just going to briefly go over Jenny, And Jenny stands for represents two things. First, Jenny is the name of our statewide collaborative, which stands for Joint Effort New York, and it is also the online resource created by IPRO. And it is the quality improvement community that is created to promote the sharing of information among quality improvement professionals throughout the duration of this collaborative. And to access Jenny, simply log on Jenny, J-E-N, one N-Y, .ipro.org. And we just want to remind you, do not type in www. So with regards specifically to SIP, if you go on to Jenny, you would see that there are several forums, and you would click on the surgical infection forum and click on the SIP quality improvement resources to access a number of the resources we have on file with regards to surgical infection prevention. And once you click on that, you can access any of the three quality improvement measures that are part of this project. And you can access an array of information, including intervention tools, some more information on barriers that exist with regards to this area of care, and some change concepts as they relate to those barriers. And additional information that you can access deals directly with data abstraction resources. And included there, again, are information on the quality improvement measures, the selected surgical procedures that are included as part of the SIP project, and those procedures include the actual procedures, their descriptions, and the associated ICD-9 codes. And you can also access information on the inclusion and exclusion criteria for the eligibility population for these three measures. And in conclusion, the last slide just outlines the team members for the various clinical topics. And you'll see myself, I am the contact person for the surgical infection prevention topic. And for acute myocardial infraction, we have Linda Azzotto. Heart failure, Linda Shields, and pneumonia, Karen Stockholm. And at this time, I want to remind you to, if you have any questions regarding this call or anything regarding this collaborative, to please use Jenny. It's an excellent tool for sharing information. Post your questions, comments, because it's more than likely any questions you have, your fellow collaboratives may have the questions as well. You can contact me at this email address to request the pre-work activity sheet that I mentioned earlier, or you can contact me by posting your request onto Jenny. At this time, I want to thank you for your attention. During this presentation, we are going to open up the line again for any questions that you may have, and I just want to take this moment also to remind you to please log on to Jenny and download the evaluation form, as we use those forms to get feedback from our audience. And also to remind you that the next clinical update conference call will take place this Wednesday on September 15th, and the clinical topic of focus on that call will be community-acquired pneumonia. Again, thank you very much, and at this time I'm going to ask the operator to open up the lines for any questions.
And our first question comes from Sherry McAfee. Go ahead, please.
Hello? Hello?
Ms. McAfee, your line is live.
Okay.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes. When you talk about receiving prophylactic antibiotics within 1 hour prior to the incision, are you talking about the start time or the finish of the infusion time?
The start time.
The start time. Okay, thank you very much.
At this time, it appears there are no questions.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Again, please don't forget to download the evaluation form and submit it to us. And we'd like to once again remind you of the next call, which will take place on September 15th, Wednesday. And again, thank you for your participation, and have a great day.